Hi, this is Katrina and Sass, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Hey, everybody, it's Katrina, and I'm here with my very good friend, Sass Jordan.
Hi, what's up?
Hey, Sass. So you just got back from the beautiful, the incredible Cayman Islands.
I sure did, and I kind of wish I'd never left. But
I'm surprised you actually came back. That place is beautiful.
It's extraordinary, and it's funny because, you know, you and I have been talking recently about finding yourself in situations where you keep hearing the same thing over and over again from people around you. In my case, it would be, what's with the negative self-talk, Sass? Or how come you always say you can't or you don't want to? You know, I know why I do it. And Katrina, of course, knows why I do it. And probably everybody else on earth knows why I do it, even though I like to try to pretend that they don't. It's because, you know, it's a form of keeping myself feeling safe, you know, because if their expectations aren't high, then no matter what I do, it's better than, oh, I can't.
Right.
See what I mean?
Right.
Oh, I can't do it. And then I do something that's little or something, you know, that's not great, but it's okay. And it's like, well, you did it. See, you did it. And it's like, yeah, I did it.
Yeah, we all feel that way to some extent, I'm sure.
I imagine, but I don't notice other people at being as negative as I am in that department.
I wonder, too, if some of it is just trying to burst the bubble. You know, before it bursts you. I find that for me sometimes, if I just say the worst thing it could possibly be, then I don't need to wait. I could just sort of go through that motion right there and then. And then anything else that good that happens from it
is better.
It's better. And so then I kind of get the high from it a little bit better too, because it's so unexpected, you know?
It's not what I was expecting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's really funny.
Join us today as we talk about all of our neuroses. Welcome.
The Neurosis Hour with Sass and Kat. But the one of my main neuroses is water. So, of course, on an island, that can become a bit of a problem, seeing as you're surrounded by the shit. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I love, love, love water, and I love the ocean. And I love being on it. I love being near it. I love the sound of it. But for God's sake, do not put me in it. I don't like to be in the water. I feel afraid. It frightens me. It's like we were talking earlier about being on a paddleboard in the ocean, and you were saying you didn't care for that because you don't like to not be able to see what is beneath you.
Yeah, it's freaky. It is. It's a total control thing.
There I am in the Caymans, and I don't have that excuse because the water looks like a swimming pool.
Right.
So I can see everything that's underneath me, and that just might be worse.
I don't know. Maybe it is. Wow.
It is, because I'm thinking all these fish and these things that could. I don't know why I am frightened of fish. It makes no, there is no sense to that at all. What happened was we went out to, me and the people I was with, went out to this area called Stingray City, where
that's inviting.
Oh my God, it's the most extraordinary, beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. The water is completely clear, turquoise, pristine, and it's like a bath. I mean, it's as warm as a bath, and it only comes up on me at the incredibly huge height of 5'5". It only comes up to my chest. But on the other hand, if it was you, it'd probably go over your head because
Because I'm a little bit really smaller. Short.
Yeah, that's okay. Anyways, it's okay to be short. You just get on my shoulders. Although you don't want to be on my shoulders because I'm like...
Yeah, exactly.
Anyways, and you go to this area, and it's an area where stingrays congregate. Now, these creatures are absolutely stunningly beautiful. They're gigantic. They're like the females are like size of small tabletops, like these big, huge, round tabletops. The males are a bit smaller than that. And they're really elegant the way they move. They just move with such fluid beauty. I mean, they're just absolutely beautiful creatures. And part of the whole deal is you get in the water with them, you feed them, they do stingray massages on you. Seriously, I'm not kidding. Oh, Jesus, HP Christ. Anyways, and you touch them and people kiss them and they hug them. Seriously, stingrays, sea animals.
Wow.
Incredible. And they're really, really friendly, or they're just really hungry and they like the food. I would say it's probably a combo of the two, but they put up with humans in a way that I can't believe it. And needless to say.
Don't they bite?
They do not bite. No, they don't bite at all.
Or
they
sting?
They have a lifespan of about 60 years, and they have one stinger that they can use once in that 60 years. And if they use it, they are then completely defenseless for the rest of the time that they have.
If so that's not metaphorical, I don't know what is. That's incredible.
And these are not the same the same genus of stingray as the type that killed Steve Irwin. That's a bull stingray. It's called a bull ray or something. And those are only found in Australia. So this is the Cayman Islands and the Caribbean Sea. And anyways, they're absolutely gorgeous, but they terrify me. And there were many, many, many of them. And the thought of standing in that water with these things touching my legs or coming near me, oh, dear God, petrified, petrified. But everybody else is like, woohoo, yahoo, la, la, la. And I can't stay on the boat without running into a major amount of peer pressure, the kind where, you know, you're being ridiculed or made fun of or told, you know, this is the only time in your life you'll ever get to experience this. And I'm like, so I don't want to experience it, but it's the kind of, you know what I mean. And I'm sure everybody listening knows what I mean. It's when you're in that position where everybody and nobody's backing you up, like everybody's saying, get in the water, get in the water, get in the water. So I did, I caved and I got in the water, and it was horrifying the whole time. I was in there for maybe 15 minutes, till the point where the guide that was with us took pity on me because he knew. I mean, I'm just like, I looked like Maria Carey in there. Terrified. Like every time one of those damn things came near me, I was like losing anal muscular control. That's a joke.
Oh.
And it was horrible, like horrible for me, not fun.
So anyways, there was not even one moment where
I did not enjoy it at all. All my own mental neurosis crap, okay? Because everybody else got over it. And everybody told me afterwards that they were a little bit afraid as well. But they got over it once they started playing with these creatures, which I don't blame them. I think it's wonderful. But I was unable to let go to that degree, probably because I hadn't had a glass of wine. This is why I advocate drinking of wine. It makes life a lot easier and more fun. You know, it's a bit of a ritual.
And no, we don't have any wine sponsors, so that is a real comment.
It's semi-true. It's not entirely untrue. No, it's not entirely untrue. Anyway, so I'm like, you know, what's with this peer pressure thing?
Yeah. It's like, heavy. I mean, you hear what's going on in schools with bullying. And I mean, that's really upsetting.
I don't think that's new. And I also don't think it's only schools. I think you see that in the workplace.
Absolutely.
I think it's life in general.
Absolutely.
If that ISIS group isn't a bunch of bullies, I don't know what they are. You know what I mean? That's bullying.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, the human nature is that if you're feeling a certain way, whether it's conscious or not, you want to be around other people that understand. So you end up spreading it. If you're depressed and you have to be around people, usually people become depressed being around you. Or, mm-hmm. And I guess all of it psychologically depends on how strong personalities you're around. You know, if somebody's really depressed and they're around somebody that is, you know, not as susceptible to those kinds of things, then maybe that person's excitement can change your depression. But I think it's all of our human desire to, you know, feel like a part of something, even in the bad shit.
Not an exile.
Right.
It's the fear of exile.
So, and yours just proves it even more in a way, because at the end, they all admitted that they too were scared afterwards. So their pressure to you is really them. I mean, here's me pretending I'm like, you know, Carl Jung, which I am not, but
Professor Jung.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, in my own practice, I do like toy around with these ideas and concepts of what is it really that's going on, to just be present with what is. And yours had such a payoff because they were all scared. So at the end, they all had some element of fear. So them saying that to you, come on, Sass, you have nothing to be scared about, really is them talking to themselves. And so that kind of diffuses it right there a little bit from the bully part. I mean, you've always heard that if you're in school and you're being bullied and you go home to your parents and they say the bully is probably being bullied at home, you know, or is bullying themselves in some way. There's always that reflection, that mirror, and we can't control what other people are doing. So it can't be our concern what the other people on the boat were doing, but I think it's a large reason about why I practice. I've had enough of those episodes of being somewhere and not being able to participate because of fear or because of I don't have that or insecurity or not feeling good enough or whatever it may be. And the peer pressure is just my own head that becomes loud because everybody else is saying what I already feel within myself. Mm-hmm. So it makes it like a lot worse for me because it's like they're in my brain. I'm mad that I can't go in. I'm upset that something is stopping me from what is deemed as truly living, you know? So when you rip it up from that place too, it's like, it's firstly somebody's opinion that that's truly living. Okay. It is somebody's opinion. Does it sound nice to swim with the stingrays? Absolutely. It sounds really nice, but I don't know if part of my understanding or my opinion of that is just based on being so socially conditioned that doing something like that would seem nice. So there's like ways you could dispel it and stand there and say, is this really living? It's how I'm showing up in the moment. If you're showing up how you did, which is getting in the water for 15 minutes, and it was absolutely horrific, I'm not sure what that's serving. You might have been serving the other people because in their minds they're going, if Sass could do it, I could do it. So you probably gave them more reason to be able to go in.
Well, I certainly gave him more reason to laugh.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It was funny.
Isn't that so cruel?
Yeah.
I've totally done it. I've totally been like, come on, laugh. This is like, live a little bit. But we've all done it. That's why I think, you know, being human, if you are aware of this kind of stuff, it gives everybody a right to talk about this. For me, one of the things that propels me in practice are enough of those moments in my mind allows me to sit down and not feel like I'm overanalyzing, but coming up with a common thread for all the things that I meet that are like the Cayman Islands boat swimming with the stingrays. And the underlining thing, one of the underlining things, is this sense of of lack of control. Now, in my cognitive mind, I am completely aware that I never have control of anything.
But you think you do. Not you, but one does think. Like, you just assume.
I think we're just not thinking about it. I think if we were thinking about it, it would become very apparent all the time that we have no control of anything.
It seems terrifying.
It does when you look at it in through that lens, but it also could seem freeing. There's a lot of stuff going on that we think we have control of, like me reaching for a glass. It feels like I have control to reach for the glass, but the my mind has made that decision. I don't remember what it was, maybe 0.2 seconds or something.
Prior to you being aware of it.
Prior to the movement.
Yeah.
And yeah, prior to the awareness of it. I'm not sitting here going, talking to you, but deep down inside going, take a breath in, take a breath out, take a breath in, take a breath out. Blood.
Circulate.
Pump, blood, pump, heart. Beat, beat, beat. I'm not doing any of that stuff. So that's happening without my control. So I'm going ahead of what my actual topic, my purpose of telling you that was. So I made a list of this one underlining reason, which was this feeling of control. So I practice when I'm not in a situation like you were in on the boat, because by that point it's too late for me, because my nervous system, which has been programmed and is responding, so reactionary, is kicking in. And in those moments, it could almost feel like I've been practicing for how long? And this is still happening? And this is still happening? Because in my mind, it's a result-oriented thing. You know, it's a mechanism in my mind that everything I do has to have a result. So if you think about practice in your mind, you might even think you're practicing for a result. But if you go beyond that, it's not about a result. It's actually about the practice, practicing the practice. Confusing as all get out. So what I'll say to that, I don't wait for the moments when I'm on the boat, when I'm in a fluid place with my practice. I practice giving up control in little spurts in ways that I can handle it. Like, say, on an average day, my mind says, have a cup of coffee when you first wake up in the morning. That's when I'll be awake. Or it could be anything, juice, whatever it is. That is your programmed response. So I'll wake up and I won't force myself to not have a cup of coffee. I'll just notice whether or not it's true that I need the cup of coffee, or that the coffee has control over me. And so I'll delay having the coffee. And there's been so many times, and that's some little tiny, tiny example, because, I mean, obviously caffeine addiction is real, but you do get over it. It's not like if you have a cup of coffee once in your life, you're addicted for the rest of your life. I mean, maybe there are weird cases out there like that, but
no.
When you stop a substance, time goes by and you're no longer physically addicted to it. So then it maybe becomes an emotional addiction. I do think that we are emotionally addicted to our nervous system responses to some extent. So,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. And I do the delayed practice of things. If I even small things, like if I have an itch, I'll count to three and then I'll scratch it. Huh. If I feel like shit when I wake up in the morning because I'm sick or whatever, I'll practice not saying, I feel like shit. And I'll say, I don't feel terrific, or I don't feel great, or whatever. It doesn't even matter so much what you're saying. I just try to break the habit that in a smaller place is feeding that larger pool of thinking and habit and automatic responses, like when you're on that boat. So being on the boat that moment, to me, is probably not the greatest time or one that will deliver much fruits of labor for you to tackle that at that moment. It's what you've done prior to that that you might start to see a little bit of giving, or at least the confidence within yourself to say, I am not at a place in my practice where forcing myself to get into the water is going to serve me in any way. And it's not even going to serve my practice, because there's this point when you kind of run on a loop in your brain when you're scared. And so facing that fear in that moment of utter fear and gripping, it's a million to one shot. It's like gambling. If you get in the water and it still makes you as scared, to me, you're just cementing that loop to keep running. Yeah. Of, see, it was scary, it was horrible. And then the chances of you trying it again, or maybe trying something smaller to show that we can let go a little bit, it gets slimmer and slimmer. Yeah. Because we're proving our nervous system right. Yeah. Wow, what a long-winded way for me to get around to that point.
No, but it completely makes sense. I love that point. Thank you for doing that, because I've never even thought of that. Yes, it does make it worse. It cements, exactly. It cements the fear, like the chances of me getting in that water again ever with those, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, so I think like Ram Dass often talks about, I can't afford the karma, you know, and I like when he says that, because I think, you know, as long as you're not hung up on what you think the word karma means, or that karma is got to be related to some sort of, you know, religious dogma of any sort. If you could just open your mind about what karma is, or forget the word karma for a second, I can't afford it in my practice. There are things that I'm just not ready for. You know, how do you know that line between you're being lazy and not proactively seeking out ways in which to challenge yourself? I think you know. I do think you know. If you're being lazy, it pretty much means you're probably not doing anything. So I'll be safe to say that if you do one thing, mm-hmm. while you're not being forced, mm-hmm. then you're not being lazy. But if we're always waiting for that moment when we're on a cliff and somebody's saying jump off, or, you know, into the 50-foot, you know, drop into the water, or swim with the stingrays, or get in a closed MRI machine. If we're always waiting for that moment and we've done nothing else up to that moment, the results are probably are out of your control. You know, I was doing air quotes, because we haven't done anything about it. And that goes for anything. If you're going to do a presentation at work, you've probably researched it. You've probably checked it out. You know, and there's that fine line between obsessing over it and being somewhat in a place that you feel confident that you can play it by ear. So what can we do to try to meet those moments? You know, for me, I take a look at the habits and the rituals, which I thought would be a really good topic for us to talk about, rituals and how maybe misunderstood we all might be about what rituals are. Because I don't know about for you, but where I grew up, and I'm not going to blame the East Coast by any means, but I will say that the family I grew up in and the friends I had and the influences that were on me, particularly when I thought about rituals as a kid, they were either associated with a sort of religious dogma, or they were associated with something like ADD. You know, where you have to constantly do the same thing, or
OCD. Yeah.
Oh, OCD. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, OCD. Doesn't matter. But yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I've seen people. Oh, God, that must be.
Yeah. And I think that to a lower degree, not like any of us, unless you have been diagnosed with OCD, we all have rituals. We're just not aware of it. Like, we all have things that scare us, and we just have never investigated it. So self-inquiry to me is about uncovering who we're showing up as, so that when the moments on that boat with the stingray and the peer pressure come, you can show up in a place of feeling confident to say no. Because it's hard when everybody else seems to be living life. Yeah. Like, this is being alive. Well, maybe being alive to you is something completely different. Maybe being alive is reading a book with peace and quiet, because every minute your kids are constantly asking you for something, or your job is 24 hours because you have to be on the phone. Like, everybody has what they deem as being really living. So if we're going to look at the things that affect us in an autonomic way, for me, that helps me feel and see the things that we truly just don't have control over.
Honestly, you said it earlier. We don't have control over anything. It's an illusion.
I don't feel like we do. And I know that there's probably people out there that are like, well, I have control over if I go to the beach today. Yeah, you do. But that's it. That's a decision. That's a thought. Now, you are taking your body into the car, but do you have any idea if how many neurons have to fire to get you into that car, to pack your bag, your nervous system, your cognitive abilities? Like, there are so many things at work inside of us every day when we make a decision, I'm going to go to the beach. Your body, your mind are working to make that happen. But past that, you have no idea if you will make it to the beach,
no.
If it will be the beach you want to get to.
If there'll be a car wreck, if you'll be
drowned,
if you don't, if there's a hurricane, out of your control. The thought and the intention are in your control, depending on your programming, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But as far as what actually happens and what you experience, there's no control to be had whatsoever.
No.
Not in relationship with another, not in relationship with many, not in relationship with the earth or the planet or the matrix or any of it. You know.
And I like that you brought the word attention up, Sass, because this might be a far-fetched idea, but what if waking up in the morning in the Cayman Islands, knowing that you were going to go to Stingray Island, and your intention you made clear to everybody, to yourself mostly, of course, but when we say it out loud, it sometimes helps. My intention is to sit on the boat and truly see the stingray from that perspective, to see how close I could feel to the stingray without feeling like I need to get up all in the stingray shit. Like, you know? Like, I wonder if we make our intention something that's not so myopic, focused, if we widen it to be, I want to be with the stingrays. That's why I'm going to Stingray Island. Well, aren't you with the stingrays from being on the boat? Are you with the stingrays with your legs dangling in the boat? Are you with the stingrays as you're in the water holding onto the boat? Or is it the only way to be with the stingrays is to jump in and swim with them and give them massages and whatever else everybody else is deeming as really living. It comes down to intention. Right?
Yes.
It comes down to intention.
Oh,
and that's what
absolutely.
Rituals are. They're a ways for us to see things in a new way. I mean, listen, I can only speak from my experience. That's all I have. I don't claim to know anything or to be preaching the religious dogma of any theology. I can only say that coming from a place where rituals were maybe looked at as a negative thing, looked at as ridiculous, or mostly it didn't work. You know that place?
Yeah.
Like, I did what you told me to, and it didn't work. I mean, that's the place of the mind, you know? In order for a ritual to be real and valid, it has to work. And I think people take rituals, that definition of a ritual, into practices. Like, I'm going to pick this practice, but it better work. That too is that myopic vision of, you know, I'm trying to run the thread through. That's how I feel when I do things because I'm peer pressured, which absolutely has happened to me. And I think what my practice is teaching me is the time to work on things. Like, the time to learn how to die is not while you're dying, although that does happen for some. Mm-hmm. It's the whole reason why the suffering that we have in our life is the things that usually garnish the most wisdom for us. They're the opportunities because we're being pushed to do it. Like, you were pushed to jump in the water and live life by swimming with the stingrays. I'm kind of a fan of not waiting for those moments.
Right.
So I just, what is it you're scared of? What could be the emotion underneath that? And for me, I'm not saying that these practices have given me this fearless ability. I mean, for God's sake, I say that in a funny way. I have Abhaya, a Sanskrit lettering, tattooed to my wrist, which symbolizes fearlessness, because I don't have fearlessness. I don't walk around with this tattoo and go, yeah, man, check me and my lack of fear out. I'm riddled with it. Riddled!
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That propels me to want to practice, not to keep waiting for the moments when I don't feel that they're going to help my practice in any way. And you can put the word practice and put in something else if you want. It doesn't, if that gives you like a bad, not you, Sass, but more mm-hmm. people possibly listening. So what it has given me, though, is the confidence to say, as I'm being given that peer pressure, what's the big deal? It's so not, I'm so surprised you're a yogi. You shouldn't be, you know, scared of this or scared of that. And those are the famous things that I can just smile now. But it gives me the confidence because I've practiced at the ability, the best intentions that I can, to say, no, it's not going to serve me. I understand what you're saying and I get it, but it's not going to serve me to try to tackle this right now. And that it's given me that. Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm not going to sit here trying to like sell practices to anybody, but it also has allowed me to soften around fears. Like, I have a very great fear, I did, of mice. It is all goes back to my days of being a real hardcore drug addict And I hallucinated about, and it wasn't a hallucinogen at the time, but I hallucinated that there were mice everywhere and they were talking to me and they were on my shoulder. And it was really horrible.
That's
horrible.
Oh my God. It sounds so bad. Fun. It sounds like Narnia. I would have loved that. Oh my God.
Wish.
Talking mice. Were they mean?
Well, of course, yeah. They were mean.
What were they saying?
I have no memory, but you know what? That's the first time somebody's ever asked me what they were saying.
Oh, well, like what were they saying? You look like a lump of cheese?
No,
My darling, you are brie.
I think they were saying...
Camembert.
I think they were saying you better do another line of Coke before somebody else... does it first.
That's so funny. You were seeing mice. Most people see like little green men. I don't know. How?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was the seed of your fear of mice. Were they white mice?
Well, it's at least what my brain is telling me.
Okay. Yeah.
It lasted for, I've been clean off of drugs of that nature for quite a long, 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 long time.
465 years to be precise.
Right. Until I started practicing, I wasn't ready to look at that, but I've had many interesting meditations with that and what it boiled down to for me. And it was really the fact that the element of surprise, like if you walked in here with a mouse in your hands and you were holding it and you slowly walked up to me and I knew the mouse was there, which is very indicative of being in the water, your feet are dangling, you don't know what's underneath you. It's all sort of the same feeling. That's different to me than I'm sitting in my studio and I all of a sudden see something. Yeah.
Out of the corner of your eye.
Exactly. Yeah. Going at a very high speed.
Yeah.
And
it's a shock. It's the boogeyman. It's the proverbial boogeyman that we were all afraid of when we were little kids.
Yeah.
You know, the thing in the closet or the thing that wasn't there when you went to sleep and you woke up in the middle of the night and there's something sitting on the chair and it's a monster. Or I'm convinced there's a monster under the bed. Convinced. To this day, and I'm not going to discuss my age again particularly, but I am past that half century mark. So, and I am still afraid of something under the bed. Like, I don't like my foot hanging over the edge of the bed when I'm sleeping because something might get it.
Yeah, so it's all feeding the same river.
What is that?
It's a fear.
It's the fear thing. So these rituals, these rituals are, in a sense, these rituals, I'm not talking about religious rituals. I'm talking about everyday things that one does to make oneself feel more comfortable in the world that you perceive around you. You know, it's comforting to go to the same coffee shop or to go to the same supermarket, I'm just using banal examples, but
it's very true.
These things that we do every day, there's a comfort in them. You know, if there's a huge earthquake or a hurricane, those rituals will not have the comfort of those rituals because the means to do them will no longer be there at that, you know, for the time being. And this is one of the reasons that we feel so lost and so at sea and so just terrified when these little daily rituals, quote unquote, are taken away from us. You know, it's a navigational tool.
Sure. Yeah, I like that. That's a navigational tool. It softened me around mice. It's not been completely tested because I haven't had one just go past my feet. But in my mind, the story is 50% less harsh for me. So it softened it.
Because you've worked on it.
I am attributing my practice to that, my intention behind it. All the words of people saying, oh, but they're so cute and they are more scared of you than you are of them. If I hear that one more time, yeah, pretty much a lot of stuff is because we are the top of the food chain. That doesn't really help me.
At all.
It doesn't help me, but I can feel that I have softened around the idea that I am the mouse and the mouse is me. I'd have to take you through years of like what I was doing, which I'm not going to bore you to death with that. But I am saying that I do now, for those people that are result oriented, I do feel a result from that, what you might deem as a ritual, the ritual of self-study. But you know what? We are involved with so many rituals now. Like, what's a birthday cake? Mm-hmm. A birthday cake is brought out on your birthday with candles that symbolize every year we've been alive. What's blowing it out and making a wish? That's a ritual. The ritual, I mean, that's not going to bring you anything, because I could talk about the rituals of like brushing your teeth, but of course, we'd be able to say, if you don't, your teeth will rot. But the ritual of the birthday cake and the blowing out the candles and singing to people, we have so many rituals. We all do. If you're listening to this, you have a ritual. You've just not maybe seen it in the light of a ritual. Mm-hmm. You've maybe seen it in the light of just, well, that's just what we do. And who cares? Why would I look into that? Well, you'd look into that because maybe it would help dispel and have a little less judgment for the religions or the practices that use rituals. Because I find that a lot of people can make fun of rituals. Oh, is that your thing? Is that your ritual? Is that this or that? And once that gets dispelled, you really do feel a bit of freedom to accept others and their rituals. Mm-hmm. I was reading this article. Let's see if I could find it really quickly. It's an article that was talking about rituals in modern day and in sports in particular. And these are rituals that, sorry, I'm saying
It's okay, you're looking for something.
I am, and I'm a really bad multitasker. I am. This is trying to prove, so it says, recent research suggests that rituals may be more rational than they appear. Why? Because even simple rituals can be extremely effective. Rituals performed after experiencing losses from loved ones to lotteries do alleviate grief, and rituals performed before high-pressure talks, like singing in public, that's funny, do in fact reduce anxiety and increase people's confidence. Once more, rituals appear to benefit even people who claim not to believe that rituals work. While anthropologists have documented rituals across cultures, this earlier research has been primarily observational. Recently, a series of investigations by psychologists have revealed intriguing new results demonstrating that rituals have a casual impact on people's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. Basketball superstar Michael Jordan wore his North Carolina shorts underneath his Chicago Bulls shorts in every game. Curtis Martin of the New York Jets reads Psalm 91 before each game. And Wade Boggs, former third baseman for the Boston Red Sox, woke up the same time each day, ate chicken before each game, took exactly 117 ground balls in practice, took batting practice at 5:17 and ran sprints at 7:17. Boggs also wrote the Hebrew word chai, which means living, in the dirt before each at bat, and Boggs is not Jewish. Do rituals like these actually improve performance? In one recent experiment, people received either a lucky golf ball or an ordinary golf ball, and then performed a golf task. In another, people performed a motor dexterity task and were either asked to simply start the game or heard the researchers say, I'll cross fingers for you before starting the game. The superstitious rituals enhanced people's confidence in their abilities, motivated greater effort, and improved subsequent performance. These findings are consistent with research in sports psychology, demonstrating the performance benefits of pre-performance routines, from improving attention and execution to increasing emotional stability and confidence.
Wow.
So again, are we going to, I mean, now listen, science isn't everything, of course. So there are some statistics for the ones that say, do rituals work? Mm-hmm. I want to introduce the thought that maybe as humans, we could relax a little bit on what works and what doesn't work, being our motivation behind trying things.
Oh, that's an interesting, yeah.
What if we just looked at rituals as intentions? Huh. So I want to set an intention to be more present. So I'm going to create a ritual that allows me to be present when I walk into a room. So I was at an ashram almost a year ago. And it's a Hindu ashram. They have this beautiful ritual where you ring a bell prior to entering the temple and you ring the bell on your way out. They ring the bell for lots of things, but for this point I'm trying to make. So I came home and I set up a bell outside of my studio. And I normally walk into a room, as probably we all do, to get something, go somewhere, or do something. But I wanted to experiment with arriving in a different way. So I didn't think to myself, does the bell work? Is this going to give me a result? Because the great thing about these practices and Buddhism in particular is that they have this wonderful way of releasing you from doing anything that you haven't investigated. So it's asking us to ask every question we possibly have. Doesn't mean you're going to get an answer, but don't believe a word anybody says. The whole act of practice is because the only way to truly be with these practices is to experience them, to have your own interpretation with them. So you can see, Sass, that every time you and I say, oh my God, no, I'll never do that. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do this. All we're doing is denying ourselves from actually getting the experience. Get the experience. Now, I know you might say, well, that's what everybody said to me about getting in the water with the stingray. What I'm saying is don't wait till you have to get on a boat and jump in a pool of stingray. I'm saying, can we slowly do this without it, because it loosens us to our own neuroses in a way that is allowing us to pretend it's within our control. So I ring the bell and I pause. It's been going on for a year now. I watch that spread to every person that comes here. Mm-hmm. Every person that comes to the studio rings the bell and pauses. And I walk into the room and I understand that there's that part of my brain that is the doer, and there's that part of my soul or consciousness or my Katrina One, Atman in Hinduism, that is desiring a deeper connection, even to a room. So how I practice walking into a room, I pause and I have the dialogue in my head, almost like a meditation ritual. This room was existing prior to me walking into it. It doesn't just become alive because I'm in it. This room is holding me. It's creating literal and metaphoric space for me. So I pause and I become grateful. It just automatically happens. I don't have to put it on myself that here I am, not walking through life asleep. For that moment I ring that bell, I feel awakened to the idea that there are things going on beyond what I am recognizing every day. And I walk into the room and say hello to what is on my puja table. I say hello. Yeah, I might sound like a crazy person, but I tell you, there comes a point when you don't give a shit.
Everybody's crazy.
I agree. And what that taught me far exceeded the bell and walking into the room. It actually allowed me to become a better listener for others. It allowed me to see how I do have control over how I react to things and how my reaction to things changes my perception of any given situation, including my judgment to rituals being dogmatic or useless or they don't work. I say if we could all work towards a place of listening to that, there's this quote in the Gita about learning that there is and I'll misquote it if I don't read it, so I do have it right here somewhere. Where is that?
It's like you're talking about to me.
Yeah.
Just taking a moment to become part of the moment. That ringing of the bell to me, just it's like you're coming into this moment. The sound is reminding you to be here now.
That's right. It is. And it may not be that way for somebody else. So come up with your own ritual. I mean, look at the Wizard of Oz. She tapped her heels together 3 times. That was her ritual. And it brought her home.
Right.
What's going to bring you home?
Oh, there you go. I love that. What a great, I like that connection, the Wizard of Oz tapping your feet 3 times and coming home. That's Aww. Like ringing the bell.
Yeah, it's it feels
home.
Like that to
you
me.
You come home into yourself and into the moment. Did you find the quote?
I did, yes, thank you. He who sees inaction in action and action in inaction is wise among men. He is a yogi who has performed all actions. So I'm bringing this up in the context of trying to become aware of the rituals that we already have and how they're serving our bigger intention and how to try to soften around this result that we all so feel compelled to walk around with as the proof of something working or not, and then us throwing it away because we are literally throwing away the baby with the bath. We are, listen to this, we are living in a deprived society as far as spiritual rituals are concerned. We suffer from oh my God, I can't talk today.
Yes, you can. No problem.
I need to do those la, 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 la.
A shortage. We suffer from a shortage.
Thank you. Doesn't that feel weird to say?
A short. No.
We suffer from a shortage. I'm suffering from a shortage. We suffer from a shortage of rites of passage, or at any rate, a shortage of meaningful rites of passage. It's true that we get married and we get buried. We have our baptisms and our first communions and our bar mitzvahs, but sometimes they don't seem to touch our hearts very deeply. In the worst cases, They're just episodes we go through mechanically. So Ram Dass had said that. And what that brings up for me is all the rituals we do that remain on the surface of our skin, mm-hmm. blowing out our birthday candles. It just remains on the surface of our skin. People that we love singing happy birthday to us. It just remains, oh, that's so nice. Okay, now what? What did I get? Let me open my presents. Let me see the result of this birthday party. Like a lot of what our culture is trying to get to the place of proof. And I think the proof and science, of course, for me, I love science. And I don't look at it as proof that's going to tell me whether to start or stop something. I look at it as interesting. It's interesting to me when science can map out what I already have faith for. So I have stopped making science an enemy. I've stopped making a lot of things an enemy, that which I can practice through. When I can't practice through it, I feel it in the form of constriction in my body, peer pressure. I don't belong. I feel that as constriction in my body. And fear is a giant constriction in my body. So like just being able to feel the confidence, right? To be able to say, no, I won't be doing that. But what rituals are already existing in your life that you're passing off as just things you do? Because that can maybe soften you if this is something even resonating for you, that the inaction that I'm taking by pausing when I ring that bell to enter my studio is a much more skillful action. But it's technically, if somebody was watching me, inaction.
Right.
Because I'm standing there and I'm taking it in and I'm allowing the moment to breathe. And I'm realizing that so much is going on without me controlling it and knowing it. I mean, really tune into your blood pumping, your heart beating, mm-hmm. your eyes blinking. All of these things are happening, yeah, autonomically. Mm-hmm. And there's such amazing beauty in that to get inquisitive, that rituals can be incredible. And they could also just be. They could also move into that realm for us of another thing you're doing. And then it's not being seen for what it truly is. Because mm-hmm. it shouldn't just become another thing you're doing, like brushing your teeth or blowing out candles. It teaches us some sacredness, you know, ringing that bell for me. And I've got lots of them. I'm sure you do too, Sass, but I like this thing that Mark Twain said, eat a live frog in the morning and nothing worse will happen to you the rest of the day.
Wow. I would never have thought as the worst thing that could possibly happen to me. I would never have thought of eating a live frog.
Well, what else bad? I mean, there's plenty bad, worse than eating a live frog, but I love the moment he's trying to capture there.
I love it.
Take on a ritual. You don't have to be a Buddhist monk to take on a ritual or sitting in an ashram learning what rituals are. Rituals are, to me, they're rites of passage, and everybody has the right to a passage, but what's the intention behind your passage? Do you want to create space? Do you want to make something sacred? Maybe if you make driving to work every day a sacred ritual, you can maybe speak to your wife nicer. You don't know, you won't know until you experience it.
It's like you're investing a moment with more meaning than you normally would, you know? And a ritual can be anything. It can literally be anything. It's not even, doesn't have, Doesn't have to be something that anyone else has ever done or ever That's will right. do, right? So it's just, it's something that makes you feel more confident, makes you feel more present, makes you feel more aware, or any of these things, you know, and more comfortable in your own skin and comfortable in this existence, you know. These are really powerful ways, tools, I'd say. These are powerful tools that we can use in our daily lives just to be aware of these things, just to be aware of what you're doing. Because you're saying like inquiry, self-inquiry, totally. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These things, it's really awareness to me. And to be aware of when you become resistant to your surroundings, to the people, the environment, whatever. It's back to that same thing that I have always adored and love more than anything else. The saying that I got from the Borg on Star Trek, which is resistance is futile. And to me, that sums up life 1,000% right there. I don't know where they got it from, but you know, the Borg was this organism that looked like a bunch of different people, but was in fact a hive mind that controlled all these people. There was one mind that controlled all these. I mean, the metaphors could go on forever, but the Borg, and wherever they went in the universe, whatever planets or other beings or whatever they encountered, they would assimilate into the collective. So you became, and there was nothing you could do. You could not resist the Borg. So resistance is futile. Don't even fucking think about it, because it ain't gonna happen to you. So, you know what I mean? Like, it was brilliant. And it's the parallels.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Resistance is futile. When you try to resist life, it never serves you well. And fear is the greatest resistance there is to life, but it seems to be out of our control. Fear is something that seems to be that we can't control our fear, it feels like, you know? And there's a million ways to learn how to do that, and to do, you know, it's like you know, anger management, fear management.
Yeah, I mean, there's no right or wrong, but you gotta do
something.
And I don't want to say do. I almost like caught myself there. Just experience difference,
and notice when you're in fear, because what happens is you'll click into a habitual behavior without even realizing you're doing it. You know, it's like a program. It's like a programmed behavior. I hate the water. I hate the water. I can't.
Oh, that's so true for me. So
me
true
too.
For me.
I think it's true for probably all
so
of us.
So then all of our habits, all of the fear habits are rituals. They're just not serving us.
Yeah, they're not serving us.
Or maybe they are.
Or perhaps they are. I mean, fear has a purpose, right? And that
is to
alert you to danger, bodily harm.
You are
Other
right.
than that, it's all in your head.
Well, and we need that part of it. It's just the reactions to fear. Like, can fear just be noticed and not acted upon unless it is truly
danger?
Danger.
I don't know about that. I mean, anyways, that's the subject for another time, because that's a big one. Fear.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Fear runs this me. Fear runs this world. And this is it's either fear or it's love. And that is the ultimate duality here. To me, it's like either fear or it's love.
Well, you know what? And I even think that fear is still love, because when you look at what fear is, if you're scared of something, you're loving yourself or your life enough that you don't want it to end. So there's fear. Otherwise, if you didn't love yourself when you thought you were going to die, that wouldn't be a horrible thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's like totally...
Woo, twist A.
Twisted, yeah, that's
twisted
me.
Twisted sister.
That's definitely me. Listen to what else he says here. I just have to end this on this.
Okay.
I remember my own bar mitzvah. I learned my Torah part. And I read it pretty well. I got lots of gifts, a thick stack of checks, and a lifetime supply of fountain pens. But that was about it. The inner meaning of the ritual never came alive for me. It was never imbued with living spirit. And I don't think I was alone in that. I think that's been a common enough experience among us. Maybe we did, quote unquote, the rituals, but it was strictly pro forma.
Who said
boys? That was, I'm sorry, that was a continuation of that Ram Dass article. It's actually called Psychedelic Rites of Passage.
Intriguing, yeah.
Yeah, and that's how many reading. People talk about that. I mean, I remember being confirmed by the Roman Catholic Church as a child. Mm. I couldn't tell you one deeper meaning of that.
To save your
at
life.
All.
I know.
And so I'm not saying there isn't. But what I'm saying is who you bring to it is what's going to give it the meaning, and that's going to come through the experience. So why not experience it and find the things that wake you up or bring you home through taking on a ritual or a habit? I don't really care how somebody's going to put it. I wasn't raised Jewish, but recently I've taken on this chant that please forgive me because I have absolutely no knowledge of Hebrew whatsoever, but I loved what it said. God, how am I going to say this? Hevanu shalom alechem. And it means we brought peace unto you. We brought peace unto you. We brought peace unto you. We brought peace. Peace, peace upon you. And it's this chant. And it's a song. Hevanu shalom alechem. Hevanu shalom alechem. Oh my God, there's so many Jews out there going, shut up, Katrina. And as I said, I'm not a practicing Judaism, but I do love reading the Torah. And who doesn't love we brought peace upon you. It's just wishing peace on you. Now, that can be a ritual. That could be a ritual. Just wake up and say that and know the inner message. Back when I was being confirmed, I didn't know the inner message. Here I am standing, embracing rituals of all different belief systems and theologies because my faith is at least strong enough to be able to practice through that. I don't have judgment coming up. And I see that it means that we're wishing peace on everybody. So if it comes in the form of Hebrew, fantastic. If I butcher it, my apologies. Then there's the guru is the self of all. The guru could be your internal self. The embodiment of truth, knowledge, and bliss. Salutations to him or her who is beyond the worlds, peaceful, independent, and radiant. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchidananda Murtaye Nisprapanchaya Santaya Niralambaya Tejase. There's another ritual. That's Sanskrit, one of the languages, old scripture languages of India. You have rituals in your life right now, whether it's religious or it's not. Maybe it's Wiccan. Maybe it's... It is religious.
Or maybe it's food.
Maybe it's food. Maybe it's drinking a glass of wine. Can you stop before you drink that glass of wine and hold space just for a second saying a nice intentional message, which maybe isn't my intention is to get piss-ass drunk right now. Because that might actually be the result.
I always bless it and ask that it be filled with the highest vibration of love.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's like, it's like saying a little prayer before you eat. It's like imbuing, but it doesn't, See, all the things that we're talking about right now are related to a sort of more of a religious or a sort of a, not necessarily, or a spiritual approach. But what you it, these things do not have to be spiritual.
I they mean, do
your ritual
not have
could be taking a hot bath at night, drinking a glass of warm milk, you know, finding a way to relax. It's, it could be anything. Always wearing a certain scent, you know. So,
but is it serving your practice, your ways, your means to waking up?
Yeah. Is it, is it,
is it serving that? And that might be too heavy and deep for some people out there, but I'm just hoping to inspire everybody while I'm inspiring myself to let go of the feeling this, this doer mentality that's approaching so much of our life from a result oriented places that, We're stopping ourselves from growing many times when we're doing things just because we want the result. And I am learning to put more intentions together that feed my value rather than the goal. Because then if I'm feeding the value that's swimming at in the highest place for me to self-study, and which in turn is studying others as well and life, then the goals that I have, they feed the value. And the goals are little moments in time where the value is running steadily throughout my life. And then the goals are feeding that. If we just keep the blinders on of reaching goals, reaching goals, reaching goals, then life becomes just about the goal, and we're missing the whole value behind it, which is something that is can be felt from us on an intentional level. Mm-hmm. So it helps me relate to people better, and it helps me go a little bit easier on myself.
It's like John Lennon's line. Well, the line that's attributed to John Lennon, which is life is what happens while you're busy making other plans.
Right.
It's about being in the experience of living. There was something that this wonderful man that I train with sometimes said to me. He said that, you know, we're so focused on exercise, giving us a fabulous body, making us look better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When in fact, if you just looked at exercise as being an integral, an extremely important part of living a full life, because exercise allows you to move in your physical body with comfort and grace and ease, instead of seizing up and getting all tight and all old and bent and all buggered up and fat and all the wonderful things that happen to us when we don't move our bodies, right? So exercise is about living life. It's not about, losing weight and becoming beautiful. It's about actually being able to live in your body, you know, and to me, that was such
beautiful,
a fantastic way of looking at it. And it made exercise seem a whole lot less unappealing. It's like, no, I'm not doing this so that I can, so that I look great. I'm doing this so I can live great.
I love that, Sass.
Yeah, I loved it too.
And it feels like you're doing it then so that you could be an active participant
in my
with your body in life.
Exactly.
And so then it opens up that exercise doesn't have to just be
about a goal
with a trainer in a gym. Exercise could also be so many other things then.
Movement of any, just moving, moving your body.
So it's opening the mind. What a great quote. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I love that. So, yes, we
can
work. I wanted to actually leave everybody with this idea or this intention.
Okay.
How would you touch the world if someone who couldn't asked to live, walk, and talk through you today? how would you touch the world? So if there was somebody who couldn't walk, couldn't talk, maybe couldn't see, couldn't hear, you could use all of them or one of them. If somebody that couldn't speak, how would you talk in the world? If there was somebody that couldn't move, how would you move in the world? But how would you move? How would your very next movement even? If they were living vicariously through you and they asked for permission to live through you, how would you be?
Do you mean,
how would you be in your body?
What do I think they would do, or what do I think they would want to experience?
What would you want them to experience?
Aha, okay, good.
So they can't walk, let's say, just for an example, and you're about to walk from here to there. Would you want them to experience you walking hard and mindlessly? Would you maybe want them to experience it slower, like check out my leg walking from here to there? Would you maybe want to just not think at all and let it be fluid? There's no right or wrong, yeah. But imagine you're walking for somebody who can't. What would you want them to experience as the very first time they have ever walked or spoken or touched somebody? You can put in anything you want, but I'd be so interested on what kind of experiences you all have from allowing somebody else to move, speak, hear, touch, taste through you as if it was their very first time. And maybe even their last. You could do it that way too. This is the last time they're going to walk. Where are you going to walk? And how are you going to walk?
Well, that's the truth, because you have no control over the fact that that might be the very last time you walk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ooh. So, whew, thank you, Sass, for that Cayman Islands intention there.
Experience. It was great. Yeah. I had a wonderful, fantastic time. I mean, it was just that moment that I thought was, wow, look, here we go again with this fear monster. You know?
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway.
And we face it and we love it because that's about the only thing we can do.
I had to drive on the other side of the road, too. I wasn't too thrilled with that either. Oh, my goodness. Well,
isn't that what we're asking everybody to do in practice? Definitely. Don't literally, but metaphorically drive on the other side of the road. Anyway, we are Zooming in the Lens, and we will talk to you real soon. Thanks for joining us on this podcast, and I'm sending love to everybody out there.
Me too. Love you guys. Bye for now.
Love you too. Bye.
Now, once you start to cultivate these planes, realizing you can't stand anywhere. Once I had found my way out, then I had to find my way back in. And I had to say, how will I live my life in such a way to integrate all these planes of reality? How do you live your life? For example, you look out at the world and you say, we're all one. At one plane of consciousness. Now, you're not just intellectually saying it. If you've really altered your consciousness, you experience the oneness of all things. But then you come back into your separateness and you say, but it's my television set. Or you say, as in Sufi Islam, trust in Allah, but tie your camel. See, it's the simultaneous planes. It's planes of reality in which it appears to be paradoxical in the way in which you live. So part of what I then saw my work to be was to keep working to deepen my connection to the one, to emptiness, to the formless, to the unitive states, to the non-dualistic component, and also function within the world, but as Christ said, be in the world, but not of the world. So you're simultaneously doing them all at once.
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to MIX.com.
FORPIX, mixforpix.com.